Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Dr. Lenora Falani, an American psychologist, psychotherapist, and political activist. She's well known for orchestrating programs that predominantly serve minority interests in the New York City area, as well as having run for political office, including president, on several occasions. She's joining us today to deconstruct her role as a political activist and talk about a few of her programs, as well as her role in addressing New York City's massive housing crisis. We'll also discuss her experience as a candidate and her view of our current political environment. Welcome to Deconstructed, Lenora.
Oh, it's great to be here, to be back.
Well, it's our pleasure. Let's talk about your role as an activist. What attracted you to that with your significant background?
Well, I came of age basically in the 1960s. I was born in 1950, but I was very much impacted upon by the activity of the 60s and that people were standing up and giving pushback. And also, by the shooting and murder of Dr. King. And I realized that in order to change the things that I didn't like or other people were struggling with in the country, ordinary people had to do something about it. You couldn't just sort of sit around and hope that it would go away. I also grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania. My family was poor. Fortunately, I was the youngest, and again, in the midst of changes in the 60s. And so everything my family had to give, I ended up getting, which meant I was able to do some things outside of the box, like go to college. And I thought of college as a place where you would go and learn how to fight for the poor. I have a degree in psychology. I'm very oppositional to a lot of traditional psychology when it comes to speaking in behalf of or, you know, making decisions about poor people. And so all of that just sort of lit a fire under me, and I decided I would do what I needed to do to get my degree and look for people or ways or possibilities of doing some new things that could really impact positively on people who were struggling in our country, and I knew them because I grew up as one of them.
Well, what a great story and what a great background. Now, you have created a number of projects, one of which particularly caught my eye was the All-Stars Project. Can you share with our audience what the All-Stars Project is about and some of its accomplishments?
I'd love to. Well, one thing is I connected to someone who's no longer with us, Dr. Fred Newman, who was a brilliant philosopher and a Jewish person who had also grown up in the poor communities. And initially left college campuses. He left it after a while. And then he hit the streets. And at the point I met him, there was so much going on in the country in poor communities. I was thrilled to have conversation and be able to work with him in an organization that really focused on the poor. So one of the things, earlier fights, was around teaching poor people, primarily of color, black and Latino, in the New York area, how to fight back the organizations that gave food and other kinds of things to poor people. A lot of times people who were working there weren't so nice. And you get related to, as a poor person, like, people can say anything they want to you, they can relate to you any way that they want, but really strengthening people's capacity, helping them to grow, to not feel destroyed by that, but to become part of a movement where that was not acceptable. And so Newman and I went on to do, with other activists, a number of things together, including building the youth programs that we have, which are at the All-Stars Project. And we've been around for 30-some years. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. And kids have gone through the program, and what we do with them is not lock them in a room and force them to read or write. We expose them to the world. We have one program, which is a talent show, which the kids have organized, and the only requirement is that there's no fighting, that people do what they're supposed to do, and it's been fine. And we have a program where we connect the young people to our donors who work on Wall Street, who are business people, who make a ton of money. And in the summer, after they go through this particular program, the kids are placed in summer internships on Madison Avenue and just places that they've never been or knew existed. So that's been really interesting because we've bridged some gaps, which I think are very important, and I think we have to do something about teaching the rich who poor people are and exposing them. And then I've done a ton of other things, but that's been the basis of the All Stars Project, and I now run programs also for the adults who live in these communities because they called me up and said, Dr. Filani, will you do to me what you've done to my kid? How could I say no?
Well, I think that's outstanding. And if I recall properly, you actually were involved with Fred Newman in forming a cultural center early on, which then merged with the All Stars Project. So you're exposing the youth in particular to cultural elements, plays, and so forth to broaden their perspective. Is that correct?
Yes, and the adults. We're located on 42nd Street in Manhattan, smack dab in the mist. And a lot of people from our communities don't come into this area or areas like this because there's nothing there for them. So Fred and I were very, very much intent on teaching people that the city belongs to everybody and also bringing people into situations where they weren't comfortable because it helps people to grow. And also, we have donors who don't know that much about the poor community, have, you know, not connected. So we've worked also from that vantage point of exposing who people are in New York who live in public housing and various other places. And it's been pretty remarkable. I mean, we have kids working in all these major corporations over the summer. They have no idea what they're doing, but what they do is they become more sophisticated because they've left their communities to see other things, and then they can take those other things back to their family and friends.
Well, Lenora, we're going to take a quick break and talk about New York City's housing crisis when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Lenora Filani, a psychologist, psychotherapist, and political activist who's fought for decades for humanitarian causes within our own country. Lenora, I'd like to talk to you about what's transpiring with New York City's Housing Authority. There was a consent decree signed the other day along with HUD and EPA through the United States AG in the Southern District and the city. Tantamount to about a $1.2 billion consent decree. They have to spend $1.2 billion over the next 5 years to correct issues they have in the housing authority, and then $200 million every year thereafter until it's fixed. There are some federal funds coming in, probably roughly, let's say, $3 billion in the first 4 years. So a lot of cash is coming in to fix the problems. But let's talk about the problems that the poor are facing and the substandard housing in the city of New York.
In about 2015, my phone started ringing off the hook. People in my programs that I ran, because I have both adult and youth programs, who lived in public housing were calling, and they were telling me all these stories. The city was offering them money to move to Buffalo out of New York City. Nobody lives in Buffalo unless you really actually have to or you want to be there. And so their families were stuck there. They were getting put out, all these rules got put into place which said if you had a son and he committed a crime, he couldn't live in your house. It was really an attack on the people who lived there. So we started to, I sent people out to organize throughout the city. We've collected 20,000 signatures in that time and began to let people know that there was an attack happening on public housing and on the poor without anywhere for these people to go. And that as New Yorkers and as human beings, that we had to stand up, fight back, and give pushback. And so in the process of that, we've impacted the speed at which this is happening. People have started to look at it from around the country because they realize that there is something going on here that we don't want to have happen. They've made these moves on places like Chicago, and if you go to Chicago, it looks like something out of the 1920s and 30s where people were forced to live. They blew up Cabrini Green, which was one of the major housing developments there. So we're still in this process, but the thing that has really made the difference is making it public and raising a lot of issues so that people, not just the people who lived there, but people who lived in the city would attend to it. One of the things that the New York City Housing Authority was planning to do was they were planning to build high-rise buildings, which they've now done in the play yard. They've gotten rid of all the open space. And these buildings are, like, very, very expensive. They're predominantly supposed to be filled with wealthy people. A lot of the people also are not people of color, but it doesn't really matter. There would be people who were distant from the poor people who live in public housing. And everyone knew that that was not going to work. That was a signal that they were planning to get people out of there. So they've done that in two housing developments. They have these huge buildings. But we've been able to impact their being able to do it beyond that. And there are 650,000 families who live in public housing in New York. And they live there because that's what they can afford. It's been a major source of housing for people for many, many years, and we have to continue to fight for it. And I think, as I said, we've made some breakthroughs. There was a piece on the front page of the New York Times, and we've made all kinds of people aware of this. And as I said, a lot of people are saying this is outrageous. The public housing should exist because that's what people can afford, and they've joined in the fight even if they don't have family there or if they don't live there.
I want to provide a quick perspective for our listeners about the elaborate deception that was transpiring and what drove this consent decree. The city, the housing authority, had been misrepresenting the truth, in effect lying to HUD to receive certification. And the types of things they were experiencing, there were 19 children, and this was what predominantly drove it, who were proven to have lead poisoning, lead paint poisoning. Over 10,000 children under the age of 6 are exposed to it. There were 300 mold cases in operative elevators where the elderly had to sleep in the lobbies of the public housing because they couldn't get up to their flat. Pest infestations. In a five-year period from 2011 to 2016, 825,000 calls to the New York City Housing Authority about inadequate heat. And all of this has been swept under the rug, if you will, by the New York City Housing Authority. So the federal government finally came down very, very hard.
And also the political people here.
Exactly. Well, you have a mayor who's been referred to as the nation's preeminent slumlord, and yet in response to this, he said, "I didn't get elected mayor to let this go on. I'm here to stop this." Well, he's been mayor for quite a period at this point in time, and this is what's happened under his administration. So what do you think the reasons are? Is it the gentrification that's driving out public housing? What's causing this type of environment and permitting this to fester in New York?
Money, money, money. And it's tied to gentrification. It's an interest in privatizing, you know, all kinds of housing in the city. And public housing sits, it's on great land and it's great spaces. And so the city wants to expand and they don't want poor people to remain there. One of the things that happened that was a breakthrough was Shola Olatoye, who was brought in to chair all of this. She and others discovered lead paint in the buildings. And what the lead paint does is it impacts the brain of young kids, and there are tons of young kids who live there. So she knew about this, but she lied about it. And I think the mayor also knew about it. I think all kinds of officials knew about it. But anyway, she was forced out of office, which was a great move a few months ago. And I think the mayor, I don't think he's taking this very seriously in some ways. I think he's confident and comfortable as a mayor, but some of this is going to impact him because Shola worked for him, and people finally stood up and said, we have to do something about this because this is unacceptable. Our kids are are being made ill, and other people, I mean the elderly and anybody, you can't live in places where there is lead paint and not be impacted, and especially you can't if you're a kid. And to hear mothers talk about the changes that they see in their young people, it's just like heartbreaking. You want to fire everybody and start from scratch.
And for people who aren't familiar with it, lead paint poisoning creates a lifelong neurological problem. So this isn't something that dissipates when you're removed from the environment. These are children who will live the rest of their lives with neurological problems driven by this. I found one of the things that was interesting is an 80-page report that the government put out leading to this, and it was a damning report of the Housing Authority. But the Housing Authority was aware of the fact that there were blood levels that were unacceptable, but they don't even report them until they exceed 15 deciliters, not to get too technical on it. But that's like ignoring the problem in Flint, Michigan. It's the exact same type of issue,
yes,
and they're
the
just ignoring the problem.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, that's why it's been helpful to publicize it and to expose the people who were not speaking out against it. I mean, we have a lot of elected officials. I'm not an elected official. I'm an activist. I have a close relationship to the community. But the job of the elected officials, including the mayor, is to respond to these things seriously and make moves to end them. So there is some activity going on, and now, you know, their efforts from Washington and elsewhere to do something about what has happened here. And I'm sure this is not the only city in which poor people are grappling with this, but it is really, really important that we continue the momentum of upgrading the housing developments that people are living in. The other fight is not allowing real estate developers to build their buildings in the midst of the parking lots and playgrounds, because again, once that happens, who's going to be forced out are people whose families have been there for three or four generations with nowhere to go. So there's a lot of things going on. And we also are not interested in having any of the public housing privatized, which is what the mayor and other people are sort of talking about. But people can't afford to live in privatized housing. In fact, that's why public housing was built.
And as I understand, there have been some rollbacks on the rent protection as well. The 1969 law that preserved rents is being exploited. There's some loopholes in it and so forth. So even that type of support, not at the poverty level, but people who have had a place to stay in the past in New York City are starting to even lose those types of opportunities.
Right, yeah. Well, one thing is that I think we've had a breakthrough. More people in the city, I mean, we literally have raised hell. We've had marches. We've organized responses in the midst of meetings that political people run. A lot of the elected officials, I think, have gotten money. I know they have, from the Real Estate Board of New York, and that's gotten exposed. So we're at what I think is a turning point in the capacity to maintain the buildings and the people who live there, and to further expose the elected officials who are in bed with the realtors and try to do something about limiting their term as, you know, public officials. I think that we've turned a corner, and that's because we've done a lot of organizing in the streets, and people feel a part of a movement, not as if this is personally happening to them, but that we can take this on together, and not just people in housing, but also people who live outside of housing, who have lived in New York forever, and they have no problem with people living in those buildings. They want them there.
Well, Lenora, we're going to take a quick break and talk a little bit about your political background when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Lenora Filani, a psychologist, psychotherapist, and political activist who has an interesting background as a political candidate as well. Back in 1992, you wrote a book called The Making of a Fringe Candidate. And let's talk about you being a fringe candidate. I can attest to having gone through that experience myself, but you've taken it to a new level. You helped start the New Alliance Party, and you've run for positions like lieutenant governor of New York and governor of New York. But you've also run for president of the United States in 1988 and in 1992. So walk us through what those experiences are like.
I actually loved it. I was the first black woman to get on the ballot in all 50 states, which means that we had support around the country. And it was wonderful to be able, I never got into a major debate, but I was in a variety of different kinds of debates. And I was able to connect to, you know, people in poor communities of color. I also was able to connect to people in poor white communities and middle class communities. I was very touched by that experience because there's no effort to bring all of those forces together, especially the white poor and the black poor. And I think if we don't do that, we're stuck in poverty in ways that we don't need to be. But it was wonderful. It was challenging, but it was a wonderful experience to see people respond and react to the possibility of building outside of the two-party system, actually going beyond parties, because you don't need to have parties in order to be able to vote and express an opinion about something. In fact, it ends up setting people up against each other. But it was wonderful. I loved doing it. I loved the debates. I loved when people, you know, who were more into the mainstream looked at me like I had two heads, because that's how they look at a lot of people in our country. And at some point, I don't know if I'll run for president again, but I like running for office. I might run for something here in New York. And I want to thank everybody who may be listening, because I got a serious vote. It wasn't anywhere near winning or winnable, but I want to thank people for just reaching out and supporting people who are outside of the status quo, who are trying to make changes in this country.
Now, you've had support on occasion, or have supported candidates on occasion, from a pretty wide bandwidth, from Al Sharpton to Pat Buchanan. Sometimes you've gotten some pushback on some of those endorsements. You also supported Michael Bloomberg for mayor as one of the Fusion candidates. And I know you've done some work with Jackie Sailett, if I recall, even forming that committee for Unified Independent Party. Can you talk about the CUIP?
Well, one thing I just want to say about the Bloomberg election, I not only supported him, I got him something like 47% of the black vote. This is unheard of. He was running as an independent, and Democrats were running against him. And I actually think he did well as mayor. But the most important thing was the message that the African-American community, which is attached historically to the Democratic Party, was able to say to the Democrats in this city, you're not producing, you're not coming through, we're going to try something totally different and see how that works. And the two or three times I think he ran, he got a strong vote from communities that normally only vote for Democrats. So I was very, very excited about that.
Now, what is your opinion of the political direction of the major parties in our country at this time?
It's bad. I mean, I think that I'm not that crazy about parties anyway. I think that they practice in ways that don't lead to the elevation or the growth or development of the communities. I think they're more focused internally than they are on transforming what's happening on the ground with people. They're not doing the kind of leadership that could make a difference. And I think that that's unfortunate. I think, you know, a lot of people thought that Obama was going to be president and he was going to make a different kind of mark. And I thought that who made the mark were the people who voted for him, all kinds of people, as the first black person to become president of the United States. But I thought he ran things very close to the chest. He didn't step out and try to grab some new things or create a new America.
Well, I would agree. I think one of the challenges we have, and when I lecture around the country, I talk about this, the parties themselves, I think, are more committed to maintaining issues as opposed to pursuing solutions. Because if you actually solve the problem,
but they can have debate.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you solve the problem, yeah, they no longer have a basis to try and use fear or greed or whatever other negative behavioral component they choose to try and exploit to secure your vote and your money in the next election. So I think it's almost threatening them to address issues like poverty and the housing issue and immigration and so forth. They'd rather talk about it than solve it. What types of changes, very briefly, would you like to see in the political system if you could ordain the change?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the disillusion or the getting rid of political parties would be great, or at least having other ways of people being able to run and vote so that no system is overdetermining who gets on the ballot, who can have their line and who can run. And I think the American people have to grow. I think we have to recognize that it's a lot of us and that what we have to do is become independent of the traditional two-party system. Maybe you go the route of a third party, but it depends on what it is and what it's doing. And maybe we could vote and make clear what it is that we want for our nation without being organized as a party. But the two-party system just isn't working, and it is actually extremely divisive of the American people, and that's what I'd like to do something about. And when Perot ran, and then I met a lot of the people who voted for him, one of the most beautiful things to me was seeing the white working class and middle class people and black and Latino and poor people sit together in rooms and try to figure out how to impact together on what our political posture and policies and parties should be. And I hope that we're able to continue in that direction. I think that everybody has to come together, or at least elements of everybody, in order to make changes. The political class isn't going to do that.
Well, Lenora, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your causes?
One place is, one thing they can do is call 212-941-9400. And I don't have my card with me, so I can't tell you what the email is for the All Stars Project. But if people write an All Stars Project and my name, it will take you to a place where you can then find out more about what the All Stars Project is doing. Actually, I just found something. So if you go to www.allstars.org, which is O-R-G, www.allstars.org, then you can find out, you can connect to other aspects of the work that we're doing, and you'll love it. It's growing, and we're doing a great job.
Well, thank you for the information, Lenora, and thank you for sharing your experience with us in deconstructing the housing crisis, which has been conveniently ignored for far too long. And I wish you continued success in helping correct that problem. So thank you again for joining us on Deconstructed.
I always love talking to you, so we should do it more often.